My dad told me a story recently where he had to go to a water treatment plant as part of his work, and he went. Oh, Sam's looking excited. I didn't even think about that one. It's not that exciting. Anyway, he went with one of the senior managers of the water company. It was part of his job. He had to go and visit this place, and he said as they arrived, they were in a hire car. But as they arrived, the security people kind of came out, and then when they saw this man in the car, and the security guard just very suddenly went, "Hello, Mr. whatever his name was," and just waved them straight on through. And there was no stopping or no checking or anything, which was because of this man's identity. You see, if my dad had just driven up, on his own, there would have been a, "Who are you? What are you doing here? Why do you want to go in there?" kind of thing. But this man's identity as a senior manager of this company meant he was known, and that affected the way the security guard approached him. We're going to think a little bit about Jesus' identity this evening as we look through these verses. And I want us to think a little bit as we do that, what impact does the identity of Jesus have? And you might be thinking, well, of course, Jesus' identity is really important. That's what it means for us to be Christians, is thinking about who Jesus is. What about in our daily lives? What about on a day-to-day basis? Does the identity of Jesus mean anything, or is it not really relevant to our day-to-day lives? Let's have a look and see what Mark has to tell us in this section. So we're moving into this section really off the back of the last section. So if you remember, Jesus sent out the 12, and we had this little sandwich where he'd sent out his disciples towards the beginning of chapter 6, and then there was a section about Herod, and verse 30 is the other end of that sandwich, to do with the disciples having been sent out. So King Herod is actually contrasted with a different king this week, which is King Jesus. King Herod is a bad king, and I don't need to tell you that King Jesus, by contrast, is a good king. I've got two headings. You can see them on your outlines, on your little handouts. The first one I've called "Pay Attention to the God Who Feeds in the Desert." Pay attention to the God who feeds in the desert. So verse 31 and verse 32, they kind of provide the context and the link into where we are in this situation. There are lots of people, so they decide to go away. But they can also teach us some things just straight away as we go into this section. There are lots of people. The disciples have just been out working hard. And Jesus says, verse 31, "Come with me by yourselves to a quiet place and get some rest." Verse 32, "So they went away by themselves in a boat to a solitary place." Jesus and his disciples are pretty clear about what they need, what they want, what they think they need. They want some peace and quiet because they're tired. However, God, in his sovereignty, has something quite different for them. Something that's going to be, as we'll see, a blessing to them, and it's going to be a blessing to us and to all the people down the centuries who have read and who will read this account. And that's true of us too, isn't it? Sometimes we have very clear ideas about what we need, what we want, what we think we need. Maybe God has something else for us. Maybe you want a night of sleep and there is a child who cries in the night. Maybe you want a quiet evening in and there's a knock at the door or a phone call. Maybe it's illness. Maybe it's just that your keys are not in the place where you expect them to be when you really need to leave the house right now. Our lives are full of unexpected events, aren't they? And that's what life is like from our point of view. But from God's point of view, it's not like that, is it? And God isn't taken by surprise when you don't know where your keys are. And we need a daily awareness, a daily reminder of God's sovereignty. Remember that verse in Romans 8 where Paul writes, "In all things, God works for the good of those who love him." When you lose your keys, when your child wakes up in the night, God is 100% sovereign. And God may well be intending to shape you and teach you something specific through that event, which is exactly the case here. So off they go. They get in the boat, verse 32, to a solitary place. But there are lots of other people who somehow know where they're going. They get there ahead of them. Jesus finds them there. The disciples and Jesus find them there. Jesus begins to teach them. And then there's a crisis, because it's getting late and there's no food, or not very much food anyway, not enough food. And we're so familiar with this story, aren't we? Jesus has this dialogue with his disciples, and then he miraculously feeds this crowd. And we think, okay, this is the miracle, this is the feeding of the 5,000. We know this story, we've read it in children's Bibles, many of us, since we were very young. But just have a look at the verses that actually talk about the miracle. Okay, just get your fingers and measure those verses on the page. So where does the miraculous start? Well, maybe it's verse 41. Jesus takes the loaves and then he gives them to all the people. Verse 42, they all ate and were satisfied. That's part of the miracle. Verse 43 is really just kind of a bit of litter picking. And then verse 44 just sort of summarizes it. So it's about that, if I do it. And then if you measure the rest of that section, you'll find it's more than my hand span, okay? So that's more of my hand span. That's interesting, isn't it? So this passage is not just the miracle. Okay, those verses are building to the climax, and it's all kind of building the suspense. But I think there's a little bit more going on. Mark is not just saying Jesus fed 5,000 people, because he could have done that in verses 41 to 44 and saved himself some ink and paper. I think he's showing something else to us. He wants us to see something else. So let's slow down and let's try not to be blinded by our familiarity with this passage and with this event. Look at, as they arrive in verse 33 and verse 34, Jesus sees them and he has compassion on them. Mark says he sees them like as sheep without a shepherd. And that makes sense in terms of the previous passage, doesn't it? You see, who is the king? The king, in everyone's eyes, is Herod. What's Herod doing? Well, he's watching dancing girls and he's beheading God's prophets. And he's supposed to be the shepherd of God's people. So it makes sense, doesn't it? God's people are like sheep without a shepherd. They're leaderless. And then verse 41, Jesus goes on to teach them, sorry, not 41, he goes on to teach them many things. We read in verse 34, after he's seen them. And what did he teach? Well, we think it'd be great, wouldn't it, if Mark then said he taught them this, he taught them that. We'd love to, I'd love to hear what Jesus taught to those crowds who'd come out. They'd run all that way because they wanted to see him. What did he teach them? Well, Mark doesn't tell us that. He just skims over it. He taught them many things. And then he slows right down. And what does he slow down for? He slows down for a dialogue with the disciples. And it's a dialogue with the disciples about what they're going to have for dinner. Okay, so you probably had this conversation. You're doing something, it gets later and later, and you say to the people with you, oh, what are we going to do for dinner? And it's a bit like that, except that here, it's a crisis, isn't it? There's a lot of people. They don't have enough food. There are no shops. There's no co-op down the road. So what are they going to do? Verse 35 and verse 36, the disciples come to him. This is a remote place, they say. It's already very late. That's the problem. In verse 36, they come with their own solution. It's not a bad option, humanly speaking, is it? Send the people away. They can go to the surrounding countryside and villages and buy themselves something to eat. That's the best option. There's no food for 5,000 people. Let's just send everyone off in different directions. Hopefully people can get to a village and they'll be able to buy some food. And if they all spread out, then they won't overload some poor corner shop with a demand for 5,000 Cornish pasties and it'll be all right. It's not a bad option. But Jesus isn't very, you get the impression he's not very impressed with their suggestion, is he? Verse 37, he expects something from them. He's questioning them. He knows the answers to all these questions and things he says to them, doesn't he? He knows he can feed 5,000 people miraculously. He could have said, look, no, we're not going to do that. I'm going to feed them miraculously. and we wouldn't need that dialogue. But what he's doing, I think, is trying to draw something out. I recognize this. I sometimes see it in myself. I see it in older people at work. When younger people come to me with a question and I could just tell them the answer, it's technically called coaching. But what I might do is say, well, have you thought about this? Have you thought about that? And you try to get people to think for themselves. I think that's what Jesus is doing here. He's trying to draw out something from the disciples. Okay, I think his words here, when he says, you give them something to eat, I think it's a little bit like when we saw Jairus' daughter. Remember, Jairus' daughter was dead. Jesus arrives at the house and people were wailing and crying. And he said, why are you crying? And the answer, of course, is obvious, isn't it? Well, because this girl has died. But he's trying to draw out, and I think Mark is trying to draw out of us as the readers, well, actually, yes, you're crying because she's dead, but there's more to it. There's more to it. Yes, we don't have any food, but there's more to it because the incarnate Christ is here. We can expect something special. So what's Jesus teaching his disciples? They have a problem they come to him with, and they have the solution to their problem. And he asks them to feed the people. They clearly can't. He asks them to find out how much food they have. How many loaves are there? Why does he get them to find that out? I think partly it's to highlight that humanly there isn't enough food. It's impossible. But I think he's trying to draw out the answer, which is that if Christ is with them, why don't they ask him for help rather than going to the Christ? And just think about what they've done. They've gone to the King of the universe and told him, this is what we think you should do in this situation. That's amazing, isn't it? I mean, does that sound slightly familiar to you? Do we ever go to Christ and say, this is our problem, this is the solution that we would like? We've decided, we've worked it out, what you should do, Lord. And we have, don't we, the promise from the risen Lord Jesus. He said, I'm with you until the end of the age. And that has to mean something, doesn't it? The risen Christ is with you if you're a believer in Jesus. When you lose your keys, the risen Christ is with you. That's not a promise that he'll miraculously produce your keys in the time and the place that you want them. But it does change the situation, doesn't it? It's not a random event with a random conclusion. It might be all right, it might not be all right. When you're trying to tell your colleague about the gospel, the risen Christ is with you. And when you receive the worst imaginable piece of news, the risen Christ is with you. It might not mean that you get what you want. What the disciples wanted that day was probably a quiet evening, a nice camping trip on the other side of the lake. And what they got, as we'll see, is rowing into a headwind all night. I've never done that. I've done cycling into a headwind, and it's very, very frustrating. I imagine rowing into a headwind is not pleasant. That's what they got. So it doesn't mean we get what we want all the time, but it does mean, I think it means two things. It means firstly that we can rest, and by that I mean rest from worrying. So we cannot worry in knowing that the risen Christ is with us. And it also means that we can trust that Jesus' plan is best. Okay, so we can not worry and we can trust in Jesus. Imagine if the disciples had done that in verse 35 and 36 instead of coming to him with, this is the problem and this is our solution. Imagine if they'd have come and said, there is a problem, but we know you're here and we trust you. And we want to ask you for help. So Jesus then miraculously multiplies the food that there is. And this, Mark is very clear as well, that in verse 38, there are only 5 loaves and there are only 2 fish. Things have been written and said to suggest this is really just about sharing, and everyone did have some food and they all brought it out and shared it. And you know, said, oh, it's all right, we'll get by if we just share enough food. That's not what Mark is saying. Mark is showing us clearly there's only 5 loaves. And yet, verse 42, they all ate and were satisfied. It's like we've probably all had this experience where you've gone to a restaurant or maybe it's Sunday lunch and you've had your food and you've had some seconds and you've had some dessert and you're just kind of sit back and you think, yeah, I'm completely satisfied. You know, if there were more food in front of me, I couldn't eat it. I wouldn't want to eat it. And that's what happens, isn't it? Because there's actually these 12 basketfuls of broken pieces of bread and fish. So these people who've run and listened to Jesus' teaching, they've had so much food that there are pieces of broken bread and fish that they're thinking, oh, I just couldn't eat that. Would you like this? No, I've had too much. I couldn't eat it. And there are 12 basketfuls. And this really, if you've seen the Mark drama, this really comes out, doesn't it? Because one of the disciples said, that's more than we started with, which is true, isn't it? I mean, it's amazing that these 5 loaves end up in 12 basketfuls of leftovers. This is a miracle. It's an amazing miracle. It's an unprecedented miracle. It's showing us something about the Lord Jesus, that he's different. And there's also something interesting here, which is that Jesus blesses the crowd through his disciples. Okay, he uses the disciples to organize the people into groups. He uses them to find the loaves that are there, that become the meal for everyone. He uses them to distribute it. He uses them to do the litter pick at the end where they pick up the baskets. He didn't have to do that, did he? I mean, remember what happened to the Israelites in the desert. You know, the manna came down from heaven, didn't it? Moses didn't get involved. The manna came down from heaven, from God. But Jesus chooses to involve his disciples. That's a great honor for the disciples. And it's also a principle that continues, doesn't it? Because Jesus blesses the world through his disciples. He blesses his church through his disciples. He doesn't need to do that, but he chooses to feed his people with spiritual food, and often that is ministered through people, through the church, through all of us to each other, and through AD especially, I suppose, to us. Isn't that a great honor that, weak and foolish as we are, Jesus chooses to use us to feed each other? But there's a bit more going on in this passage than if we just left it there. You see, this section, this account of how Mark describes Jesus feeding these 5,000 people, it's littered. It's deliberately littered with Old Testament symbolism. So that's why this is where your table comes in from your handout. We're not going to turn to all those Old Testament passages now, but I'm just going to quickly go through them. There are parallels. So in Exodus 16, the Israelites find themselves in a desert. And here, these words that are used by Mark for when, in verse 32, they go to a solitary place, verse 31, a quiet place, those words suggest a desert. Okay, it's a similar wording in the original, apparently. And those words that Mark uses of Jesus when he sees that the people, in verse 34... are like a sheep without a shepherd. Those words are actually spoken by Moses in Numbers 27. So the idea, if you want, you can fill out the right-hand side of the column, that's the idea, if it helps you against each of these things. So Moses in Numbers chapter 27 and verse 17 speaks of the people of Israel as being like sheep without a shepherd. And shortly afterwards, in response to that, God appoints Joshua. And here, verse 34, Jesus is described as seeing the people as being like sheep without a shepherd. In Numbers 11, the people are crying out for meat, and Moses is despairing and saying, how can I feed all these people? It's not possible. And just like the disciples, in verse 37 to 38 of our passage, they're saying it's not possible to feed all these people. In Exodus 81, we find Moses organizing people into groups of hundreds and fifties. In verse 40 of our passage, Mark doesn't need to tell us this. He chooses to tell us that Jesus is directing them to arrange the people in groups of hundreds and fifties. And then, of course, there's a miraculous feeding. And that should remind us of Exodus 16 and the story of the manna that God provided miraculously for his people. And finally, at the end of our section in Mark, in verse 46, Jesus leaves them. In our translation, he went up a mountainside to pray. Maybe he went into the hills to pray, but I wonder if that's reminiscent of all those times, including Exodus 19, when Moses, we're told Moses went up the mountainside to pray. I think these things are here. It's no accident. Mark is very carefully arranging his material. And what's he showing us? Well, who did the feeding of the Israelites in the desert? Who fed the Israelites? It was God. God fed the Israelites. And who feeds all this crowd of people in Mark? It's Jesus. So what's the message? Jesus is God. Jesus is the God who feeds his people in the desert. This is the fulfillment of Exodus. Jesus is the one. So where does it go from here? Well, look at verse 45. And it all kind of disappears, doesn't it? Immediately, Jesus made his disciples get into the boat and go on ahead of him, while he dismissed the crowd. Very quickly, very kind of abruptly in Mark's account, Jesus sort of dismantles all this symbolism. And it's all disappeared. The disciples are made to get into the boat. That's quite strong. It's literally, he forced them into the boat. You can imagine him kind of steering them towards the boat, maybe physically, and pushing them into the boat from that kind of language. And then he dismisses the crowd. I wonder if it's because he's trying to make it clear that he's not about to lead them all off into the desert in some kind of new exodus. And this was just a symbol. This is just a kind of shadow to show us who Jesus is. Maybe it was just a teaching point for the disciples. That's why he draws them into this lesson in his dialogue with them. So what is the lesson? Well, Jesus is God. That means we need to pay attention to him. You see, if Jesus is just a good teacher, then you can look at his teachings, you can decide what you think of them, you can take some of them, you can ignore the ones you don't like, the ones you don't agree with, the ones that are hard. But if Jesus is God, then we need to take very seriously what he says, and we need to take very seriously how we respond to Jesus, how we respond to the God who feeds in the desert. Okay, second point as we move into the second section of our verses is, I've called it Jesus demands a heart response. Looking from verse 46, 47 to the end. So we find Jesus after dismissing the crowd, going up on a mountainside to pray. That might not strike you as remarkable, but apparently it's one of only 3 points in Mark where Jesus prays. Okay, only 3 points in Mark where Jesus prayed. I didn't believe that, so I looked it up, and it's true. There's only 3 instances. Obviously Jesus prayed a lot, but Mark only tells us of 3 points where Jesus prays. One is in chapter 1, right at the start of his ministry. One is here, and one is in Gethsemane. Okay, so this should make us wake up and think, that's interesting. What does that mean? What's going on? It's interesting, we don't know what he prayed. I think it shows us something important is going on, and it comes in the middle of a sort of two-part lesson that Jesus is giving his disciples. I imagine that he was praying for his disciples to wake up and get what was going on and see it, because Jesus has a vital lesson that he wants to teach his disciples. So let's look at what happens in this end of chapter 6. So Jesus has forced the disciples into the boat. They're off. He's dismissed the crowd. He's on his own, praying. The disciples start rowing out onto the lake. And there is a wind that has grown up against them. And they're struggling against this wind. And Jesus is still on the shore. And what's interesting is that God has put them in that situation. Okay, they're straining at the oars. It's hard, it's difficult. But they're exactly where God wants them to be, aren't they? Jesus ordered them into the boat and told them where to go. And just because it's hard doesn't mean that we're doing the wrong thing. Just because it's hard doesn't mean that God doesn't want us to be in the place where we are. Often the path of duty and obedience means hard work. We think today, especially about all those men In the First World War, he went off to fight, and so many didn't come back. And we rightly remember them, and we rightly call them heroes. But when they went, I don't think they went to make heroic sacrifices. I don't think they went because they reasoned that it was the best thing to do, or the logical thing to do. I think most of them went out of duty and obedience. Okay, they went because they were brought up in a society that values duty and obedience in a way that perhaps we don't today. You see, today, if something's difficult, if your career isn't going where you want to, you change career. If your marriage isn't satisfying you, you get a divorce. We don't have in our society necessarily a concept of duty or a concept of obedience. Maybe we need to push back against society on that point. So the disciples are there, they're toiling at the oars. That word that's used as they're struggling is linked apparently to the word that is used for demon possession and words that are used for the torment of hell. Okay, so maybe there's even an indication that this wind that they're facing is more than just a normal wind. Maybe there's something, some darker power at work there. And yet God wanted them to be in that boat in the middle of that lake. That's a great encouragement for us, I think, when things are tough. And sometimes things are difficult, aren't they? As we follow Christ in the place he's put us, in the job he's put us in, or on the course he's put us in the house that we're in the family that we're in. Sometimes things are really hard. But we can be encouraged, can't we, that God knows exactly where he's put us. And he has a purpose for where he's put us, as we'll see in the case of the disciples. So while they're in this boat, they're toiling away. Jesus can see them. I don't think that's supernatural. I think it's not a massive lake. I think he can actually see them. And he comes and shows them that he's God. So it's a little bit like the first miracle we saw on the lake back in chapter 4 where he calmed the storm. Except here it's even clearer because he walks across the lake on the water. Okay, only God can walk on water. That's a key fact for this passage. Okay, I went swimming recently and I tried it. You can try it yourself. It doesn't work. If you try and walk on water, your feet just go through it. Okay, you can't walk on water. Only God can walk on water. And then he's walking. He's about to. It's as if he's about to walk past them, and they're afraid because they know that no one can walk on water, and they assume for some reason that he's a ghost. Verse 49. And verse 50, they see him and they are terrified. And when he hears that, or when that happens, he speaks to them immediately and he says, "Take courage, it is I, don't be afraid." So he's saying, I think, what he's saying works on two levels. Firstly, he's literally just saying, "Look, it's me, it's Jesus, it's okay, don't worry, I'm not a ghost." And he gets in the boat. But there's also something else going on there, those phrases, "It is I," literally, "I am." And "don't be afraid." Well, "don't be afraid" is something we hear of God in the Old Testament, don't we? "I am. Don't be afraid." So he's saying, "Look, it's me, it's all right." But he's also saying, "Listen. Listen to the words that I'm saying to you. What do they remind you of?" And as soon as Jesus is back in the boat, the wind dies down and they're amazed. The point is, Jesus is God. Jesus is God. How amazing. And yet, as Mark frames even this account, just look back to verse 31. Remember that it's busy. There's lots of people. Jesus says to them, end of verse 31, "Come away with me by yourselves to a quiet place and get some rest." Okay, there's two possibilities there. Either Jesus knows exactly what's going to happen. He knows they are not going to get any rest, and he's deceiving them. He's saying to them words that sound to them as if they're going to get some rest on the other side of the lake. But they're not, and he's deceiving them. The second possibility is, he doesn't know in detail what's going to happen. Okay? So he's saying, "Let's go and get some rest." And then all of this All of these things happen. And look at verse 34. As they land on the other side of the lake, they see a large crowd. Jesus has compassion on them. So it doesn't say Jesus knew exactly what was going to happen. He got in the boat. He got out his sermon notes. He went over them to make sure he was exactly knew what he was going to say. He practiced his bread multiplying miracles because he knew that was going to come up. No, Mark doesn't say it like that. Mark says, just as we would of someone else, he saw some people and he reacted with compassion. So Jesus is God, but Jesus is man. Jesus is a man. He's a man who said, let's go and get some rest. And it turned out differently. He's a man who saw a crowd he wasn't expecting and he reacted with compassion. And yet, he is God who walks on the waves. Isn't that amazing? Isn't that amazing? And the disciples are amazed and yet, they don't get it. Verse 52, they'd not understood about the loaves. Why didn't they get it? It's not because they're thick. It's because their hearts are hardened. What a tragedy. Their hearts are hardened. In verse 53 to 56, we have this little section where it's kind of all this stuff we've seen so many times before. They arrive and all these people are coming and bringing people to be healed. And I think it's there because it provides quite a contrast. They land in verse 54. As soon as they got out of the boat, people recognized Jesus. People recognized Jesus. So the disciples don't get it, but there's all these other people who recognize Jesus. The disciples have completely failed to recognize who Jesus is. These people, on the other hand, are deeply attracted to Jesus, and they act according to what they recognize in the Lord Jesus. May we be more like them than the hard-hearted disciples. Jesus demands a heart response. See, that's what Jesus' identity demands if we get it. If we know who Jesus is, which we do because we've just read it. He demands a response of the heart, not just an academic understanding. And finally, as we close, according to some commentators, the way that Mark structures this part of the account and the words that he uses are reminiscent of Job chapter 9. So we're just going to turn to Job chapter 9. I probably, like a lot of Christians, don't read Job very much, maybe not as much as we should anyway. But bits of Job are amazing and bits of Job are very challenging, and I'm quite looking forward to the time when we get to it and when we preach through it. I think it'll be a challenge and a blessing to us. But this is Job in chapter 9 responding to one of his friends, one of the people who talked to him when he's suffering. And we're going to read, it's worth reading the whole chapter, but we won't do that right now. I'm going to read verse 8 to 14, and then a little bit later on. He alone, this is God, Job talking about God. He alone stretches out the heavens and treads on the waves of the sea. Sound familiar? He is the maker of the Bear and Orion, the Pleiades and the constellations of the south. He performs wonders that cannot be fathomed, miracles that cannot be counted. Sound familiar? When he passes me by, I cannot see him. When he goes by, I cannot perceive him. If he snatches away, who can stop him? Who can say to him, what are you doing? God does not restrain his anger. Even the cohorts of Rahab cowered at his feet. How then can I dispute with him? How can I find words to argue with him? And Job goes on and describes his frustration with how he sees God as kind of maybe unapproachable. We're going to just jump down to verse 32 of Job chapter 9. He is not a mere mortal like me that I might answer him, that we might confront each other in court. If only there were someone to mediate between us, someone to bring us together, someone to remove God's rod from me, so that his terror would frighten me no more. Then I would speak up without fear of him. But as it now stands with me, I cannot, says Job, I cannot. And back in Mark, what happens? God treads on the waves of the sea. He is about to pass by the disciples, just like in Job. But in Job, God is kind of mysterious. Job is frustrated by how God is so untouchable, so unreachable. But Jesus is different. You see, the disciples experience this terror. And Jesus doesn't pass by. Jesus says, it's all right. Immediately, he says, it's all right. And he joins them in the boat. You see, Jesus is the missing link of Job chapter 9. He's the missing mediator of Job 9:33. Because where Jesus is going is he's going to the cross, of course. That's where Mark is taking this account. He's going to make atonement. He's going to, in the words of Job, he's going to remove God's rod from the sinner who repents. He's going to remove that terror that Job feels. Isn't that amazing?